hear this word study. The hard part about reading this point, anybody have trouble reading this? Or like some reading they would put it off. But these are dramatic works. It's all language. Everything's coming at you through your ears and, you know, lighting up your brain and creating images. It's the opposite experience of watching a movie or television, where everything's coming at you through your eyes. So this is the biggest shift in education really in the last 30 years, and it gets to be very hard to be a reader. Plus the fact that originally this came to you through your ears, not through the printed page. So what you're doing when you're reading this is trying to hear. I was taking attendance, so why don't you give me your Jeremiah Hammond. I wasn't taking attendance, I was just finding out these things. You have to get those marks off the page, and you have to hear them, or they're kind of meaningless. And that's really a difficult thing to do, all right? And it's a lost art. And I can say that reading these things is tough even for me. And of course, I'm not that smart, but it's tough. I always wonder when the actors in Hollywood are saying, well, I read the script and I loved it, and so I took the part. And, you know, I don't believe them for a second. Their agent said, I hear this is a good part. You know, we'll see what happens. Oh, yeah, okay, I'll do it. And I just really don't believe that many actors sit down and take those big scripts home, because it's too hard to transpose the page. Yet that's what I expect you to do by asking you to read a play like this. But let me get back to that. I'm going to do something really weird today. I was reading a book on cowboy and westerns, and I should have read it 30 years ago, because just sort of a theory of the. Do you ever watch westerns? Does that mean anything to you guys? Is that a dead format? I mean, when I was a kid, there were an awful lot of westerns on television, and I don't think there are that many today. Are there any westerns? I mean, it's all reality programming. But then the movies, you get westerns, but now it's turned into, Brokeback Mountain, which is a western, but it's not exactly the theme we used to think of when we watched that. But I think you've seen enough of them, the old Clint Eastwood westerns. Remember Clint Eastwood got started with Sugarfoot. Yeah, but before that, he was a TV star in the 50s. And these things still run on some of the odd channels, and they're absolutely gripping. And the Western, I started thinking about it in my Shakespeare on Film class, because it's very hard to put Shakespeare on film. You lose a lot of the language of Shakespeare. What a lot of directors figured out is, you want to make a good film about Shakespeare, just put Hamlet on a horse. Now, there's no horses in Hamlet. But you put Mel Gibson on a horse, and everybody says, that Mel Gibson, he is the greatest Hamlet I've ever seen. Well, he's actually really bad, okay? But nobody notices, because he looks good on a horse, right? And he's got that kind of cowboy mentality. And what that director did was take his Mad Max character and say, well, Mad Max is like Mad Hamlet. Like, I will give him a horse, you know, makes for a good movie. Well, westerns grew up with the horses. Silent film was founded at the time when cars were just coming into popular usage. If you think of 1910 to 1920, the Model T Ford is a product of about 1911. And it took a while for the horses to get displaced. So if you're making a movie like John Ford was, a silent movie in 1918, the horse is still something interesting and a very filmable commodity. A horse always looks good in a film. So westerns have this this impact, but they also have a certain type of story that it's good versus bad. Right? And I was thinking about that, and I read this. I want to read this to you and throw tomatoes, whatever. if you have anything to say, but it's a kind of review of where we've been before I start with these tragedies. All right, this can take about 10 minutes, I think, maybe more. And this book I was reading, he's asking himself, what makes a Western? What are the elements that you have to have? Okay. And he decides that Westerns are characterized, above all, by the setting of the story. It's got to be in the West. Right? That's a big part of it. Then by the characters, the marshal, the good guys and the bad guys. And less importantly, by the types and of situations and patterns of action. So the last thing you really care about is the plot, whatever we mean. The plot is all important for a tragedy. So the Western is really, as I'll talk about a little later. Anyway, most of the elements of the Western fall in the category of setting, which is an odd reversal of the priorities of Aristotle's poetics. What, maybe that's too much. I'll read it. What separated poetry, Aristotle's, when Aristotle talked about poetry, he meant stories. He didn't mean little poems. And Mary Had a Little Lamb. A poem was a made thing, made out of words. Right? A tragedy is a poem for Aristotle. And the poetics is his discussion of the Oedipus Rex, which we're doing for Tuesday, is the central document in the literary era. It's just hard, I mean, this is a course about Western literature. It's just hard to fathom it, but other cultures didn't have an Oedipus Rex. But when they did start writing stories, they started reading these Greek tragedies. So this stuff's enormously influential all over the world. Our relationship to ancient Greece is just about really as far away as southern India or northern China. I mean, they are very different from we were, but we read these things anyway. So what separated poetry, Aristotle's inclusive term for stories, from other fields of inquiry, such as rhetoric or politics, was above all the plot or mythos of a work of fiction, followed by character, thought, fiction, melody, and spectacle. Aristotle said you can take any story, any movie, any drama, and you can look at it in terms of plot, character, what the character's thinking, how you know what he's thinking, what he says, okay? The sound of what he says and the other sounds, the whole musical background, and the spectacle, or the visuality of it. By defining the Western by means of the setting, this book I was reading, admits the limitations of formula as a device for understanding poetry, and instead explains the success of the Western formula in terms of something else. So this book, because its analysis is cultural rather than structural, he naturally has to remove considerations of quality from his audience. He just says, how's it built, not is it any good, right? Although he is clever enough to reintroduce this question of quality at the end of his book when he admits that the Western is really a fairly impoverished form of romance because it casts itself as a story in terms of a clash between good and evil, between the values of civilization as embodied in the isolated town and to a certain extent the epic grandeur of the landscape of the American West, good, versus savagery, evil, as represented either by Indians or outlaws. And what makes it interesting, often by, to a certain extent, by this evil is represented by the qualities of the hero who has to resolve his own savagery. See, he can't defeat the evil unless he's got little evil in him. You know, he's got to be good killing people. But then he's got to hang up his guns at the end, right? So you get the idea how the hero works to resolve this good versus evil thing. Does this make any sense to you? A little bit. All right. This savagery in the hero allows him the strength to confront and defeat evil, either by joining the forces of civilization, marries the barroom keeper or the school mistress, or he rides off into the sunset because he says, I can't stand it. Got to be on the road, right? What is missing from simpler Westerns like The Lone Ranger are the moral ambiguities that resist being put into formulas and resist resolution. Most particularly, the human wish for immortality. That seems to be missing, what I've been talking about all semester seems to be missing completely from the Western. Okay. In great literature, including the better Westerns, these ambiguities arise from the hero's realization that he cannot live forever, but has to die. Now I'm going to try and get this simple, but I got to tell you, your essay on the midterm exam is going to be talking about something about the force of immortality. All right? And I want you to do your own thinking, but that's the theme I've been hitting all semester, and I'll pose some question to you in some form. So you want to get, I'm not trying to read you the answer here. I'm just sort of getting you thinking about it yourself. But if you just think about it, you can't lose. If you don't think about it, you'll lose. Okay? There's no right or wrong answer here, but you want to be conscious of it. Okay? The hero realizes that he cannot live forever but has to die. Gilgamesh, to take an example, this book on Westerns does not mention, is the hero of an ancient Babylonian poem who murders and rapes until he realizes that all the violence that establishes his power means nothing, because he himself must still die. This realization of his own mortality coincides with or prompts his dawning sense of right and wrong. That is, he realizes his murdering and raping must be wrong because it does not give him what he most desires, to live forever. To find immortality, he seeks out a magician in the story we looked at, a sort of Noah figure who recalls the flood by which the gods punished other men for their wickedness. Utanapishtim, remember him? Remember him? You better remember him. You want to remember this guy. Utanapishtim, having been warned to build a vessel, survived the flood. In the story, he survives because one of the gods tricks the others and warns him, not because he is a particularly good person. Although, as in the Bible, it seems that a clever trick is often a symbolic substitution for moral goodness. Jacob's tricking of Esau or Joseph's tricking of his brothers makes for a good story and also a good moral when understood this way. The trickster is clever, he's got something going, he understands life, right? What follows in the story of Gilgamesh also shows how heroic adventures operate as heroic substitutes for virtue. When Gilgamesh asks Utanapishtim for the secret of eternal life, Utanapishtim gives him two tasks, to stay awake and to pluck the thorny plant of eternal youth. Gilgamesh fails both tasks, which seem destined to show him, the first symbolically, since sleep is a form of death and staying awake can easily be interpreted to represent immortality, shows him that he cannot live forever. Nonetheless, Gilgamesh's heroic defeat in these tasks provides the symbolic resolution to the contradiction of life, that nothing one does can prolong it, since even though he fails admirably. We have seen him, despite his defeat, transform himself from a monster to a man with a sense of right and wrong, even if this simple morality only depends on his realization that there is a power superior to himself. The story of Adam and Eve contains a similar lesson in the limitations of mortality and the dream of eternal life. God punishes Adam and Eve for violating his prohibition against eating the tree of knowledge. But in a separate development, he banishes them from paradise specifically so that they will not eat the tree of life. The first part of the story is about the acceptance of the conditions of life in this world, which is work and the tribulations of reproduction. Remember the punishment of Eve? The second part is what paradoxically releases man from his toils, to which death eventually brings an end. By not being immortal, it means you're not doomed to work forever. Okay? What seems evil in some sense turns out to be a good. In this case, the good is the existence of God's justice, even though Adam and Eve, who represent us, are the victims of it, since a belief in justice allows one to escape the despair that must be the result of living in a world of only random violence. That is, God's justice is the imaginative resolution to the problem of why we have to endure a life of toil and pain. The The particular brilliance of the biblical stories may be gauged by comparing them to the simpler presentation of right and wrong that we find in things like the American Western. According to Kowalty's book, which is called The Six-Gun Mystique, it was written in 1971, the Western hero is the embodiment of a particular moment in history when men were forced to sacrifice their masculine virtues and codes of honor in order to recognize and contribute to the inevitable growth of progress in the form of the coming of civilization to the American West. Western stories can be analyzed in two ways, in terms of their function or how they affect their audience and their structure. In terms of structure, the most important things are the setting and what Kowalty calls complexes of character. Each of these can be more or less complex along a continuum from the simple opposition of good and evil to complicated presentations of moral ambiguity and clashes of competing values. The setting of the Western is always on or near the frontier, where the forces of civilization or law and order are inevitably, progressively overcoming savagery, whether represented by Indians or lawless outlaws, along with some elements of the savagery that we admire nostalgically. Strength. Odysseus is the first example of this. I mean, he's a bad boy, but he's so smart and so strong. You know, you can't help but admire him, although it's kind of hard to do it off the page, but he's the type of every cowboy who wins a duel. Okay. Strength, codes of honor, male freedom and camaraderie, openness, naturalness, and grandeur. This is what the Western's all about. The landscape itself symbolizes this conflict, since it is arid and barren, but it is also magnificent. I don't know if you've ever seen Shane. You ever seen that? I hate it, but it's a really famous Western. He's got this desert, and there's this house sitting in the middle of it. Okay, and you see this all the time. I mean, there isn't a piece of wood for 300 miles in any direction, yet they got this wooden fence and this house and stuff, right? It's just symbolic isolation, this little bit of civilization in the middle of the desert. Now, in fact, how it got there, Kowalty doesn't talk about, but these things were the product of railroads who trucked in all these. You bought your farmhouse from Sears Roebuck in the 1870s, and it came out by train. They dropped it on the side, and you hauled it in your cart 50 miles away, and you built it according to the numbers. There's still plenty of Sears Roebuck houses around here. We weren't the far west, but they also got out there to Kansas and to other places I've only heard of and never been. Anyway, in this inhospitable and hostile land stands civilization, often in the form of a lone, isolated, threatened frontier town. The cowboy story inevitably resolves this conflict by defeating the bad guys. That's the easy way to do it. With the result that nature itself is tamed as the landscape opens up to the forces of civilization. You've heard this rhetoric of defeating evil. Still do it. Okay. The Western. No problem. Good, evil. Right. This contrast, by the way, this good and evil, it's a product of the American Westerns. It contrasts with colonial stories set in jungles, I think anything you've ever seen, where the landscape itself is threatening and untamable, and always likely to remind us that human violence can never be tamed. When you win in the American West, you have this gorgeous sunset. You know, when you defeat whatever's going on in the jungle, there's another snake coming down off the tree to wrap itself around your neck. Okay, so that's like the setting is all wrong for this good versus evil thing. So the American West was just perfect for this myth of progress that Americans had. The myth of the Western, which is the American myth, is that violence can be tamed and even eliminated. You know, this is written 35 years ago. According to Kowalty, another aspect of setting is costume, which consists usually of giving the good guys white hats and dressing the bad guys in black, although the colors may be reversed for ironic effect. The good cowboy with a black hat, right? Townsmen dress in suits, and women wear long dresses to stress their role as purveyors of civilization, although often there's a contrast between the inappropriateness of this dress to life in the West and the correctness of what the cowboy hero wears. The simple fashions of the townspeople show their insufficiency in contrast to the garb of the cowboy hero, whose readiness to defeat whatever threatens civilization is symbolized by the ornate costumes of the hero himself. Think of Odysseus getting dressed if you want to. His 10-gallon hat, his tight pants, his low-slung gun belt. But also the fancy stitching and tassels and cured buckskin that associate him with a vital element of the natural landscape that will have to eventually and inevitably yield. Either when the hero comes out of the wild and marries into the town, or unable to tame his own wildness, so necessary to defeat the villains, he rids the new world of his own presence by riding off into the sunset. I mention the costume at length because this account helps explain the otherwise strange role of Joseph's coat of many colors, which in the original text is actually a coat of long sleeves. Yeah? What? The cowboy thing? No, I was reading it, and at the same time I was teaching you guys, and I thought, I don't know, I thought sort of was interesting. I just thought this up last week. I didn't thought it. And let me know if it seems absolutely mad to you, let me know. But, it's a strange story. Right? The difference, in the original text, it's actually a coat of long sleeves. And in your book, it's actually something else. Remember, I forget what the footnote is. Well, an ornamented coat, which is like, the Roy Rogers with all the stitching. It's so weird. What's with these fringes? It's like you see these guys in the motorcycles, with the leather pants. The fringe, I don't get it. But that's, they're replaying this. They're the good guys, you see. Right? Rolling Thunder. Right? What? It looks good in the wind. Flaps dramatically. Yeah, when I was a kid, we used to put baseball cards in the spokes of it. Anyway, you get the idea that, let's see, I can't remember my point here. Anyway, the difference, whether it's a coat of many colors or long sleeves or fringes, does not matter, since the point is that Joseph plays the role of the cowboy hero, who through some disaster in his past, and often the hero in these stories, shot somebody in the East or went bankrupt, and that's why he wound up in Wyoming. That's the original story of The Virginian by Owen Wister, which I was assigned in junior high school and, believe me, did not understand. Okay, but I was assigned it. But you might want to go read it someday. Okay, Joseph plays the role of the cowboy hero who through some disaster in his past, has been forced into the land of savagery, where he learns its ways and gains the strength and knowledge and opportunity to defeat it that would not have been available to him had he remained in, say, the East or in town. Think of what was that, I can't remember anything. That movie by, who played in Field of Dreams? Kevin Costner, remember with the buffaloes and all that? Did you ever see that movie? Yeah, that's with wolves. I mean, see, he has a disaster in the Civil War. He shot somebody or didn't obey orders. And something chased him out, and he had to learn to survive. That's a slightly more advanced Western thing. Okay. In this case, the little disaster was Joseph in the house of his, that drove him out. The cowboy hero, through some disaster in his past, has been forced into the land of savagery, where he learns its ways and gains the strength and knowledge and opportunity to defeat it, an opportunity that would not have been available to him had he remained in, say, the East or in the town or, in the case of Joseph, in the house of his father Jacob. For the story of Joseph is also the story of a clash of cultures, of good versus evil, which takes the form not of the coming of civilization and the myth of progress, but of a contest of magics between the idols of Egypt and the monotheistic god of the house of Jacob, whose sons will become the ancestors of the 12 tribes of Israel. How else is the story of Joseph like a Western? Oh, there's an exam question, yeah? Any time we have choice in literature, it makes for a more thoughtful story, it seems to me, more interesting. Okay, it's when it seems mechanical that we lose interest, and you have the cheap Western, the Lone Ranger kind of thing. But if the guy's actually thinking, that seems to me, and deliberately choosing and realizing maybe this, maybe that, but that makes it so much more interesting, doesn't it? Because that gives him, makes him a personality and not a robot. And we like personalities, I think, okay? I mean, I haven't been stressing this choice thing, but certainly it's a big thing for me in other classes. Just this early literature is so tough to get a handle on. But I agree with you. Do you think that's true? That the choice makes it more interesting? Okay. Yeah. Well, hang on to that. We'll try and... Anyway, how else is the story like a Western? There's one for you. Like the cowboy hero, Joseph lives by a code of honor that is represented by his ability to avoid the seduction of women. The women are irrelevant. It's the point that's just symbolic. It just shows he's a good guy who knows right and wrong. Okay. He is also reluctant to kill. The cowboy is usually reluctant to kill. Ah, I hate to do this. You know? And it's quality point. I thought this book was brilliant. He's reluctant, and he never kills close up. It's always got to be the distance, got to be clean. Makes it somehow better if you're not there slitting a guy's throat, you see. That still goes on today. If somebody chops off somebody's head, that looks savage. You drop a bomb from 30,000 feet and blow up. I don't know what happened. I didn't see the burns. You know. Seems clean. Seems more just. Powerful myth, right? Well, anyway, he lives by a code of honor. He is reluctant to kill, and when he does so, it is never hand-to-hand with a bottle or a knife or fist, the cowboy hero, but he does it cleanly at a distance. The single shot from his unerring long rifle with which Leatherstocking, the hero of the earliest Western by James Fenimore Cooper, sights on a mountaintop and shoots the evil Indian Magua in The Last of the Mohicans. You heard of that? Is prefigured by the ability of Moses to rely on a series of 10 plagues to force Egypt's Pharaoh into releasing his people. Or we didn't do the plague things, but that's a big deal. That's a contest of magic. What makes the Bible story so entertaining is the irony that Joseph, who is so clever at reading dreams, such a bright boy, is the one who brings his family to Egypt, where they are enslaved for generations until Moses can release them. Those generations pass in a flash between the end of Exodus, between the end of Genesis and the beginning of the book of Exodus. But if we keep what finally happens in mind, Joseph's cleverness seems not so clever. In fact, it is kind of funny. This is a kind of digression now. Now, this humor, wry as it may be, exists despite what your introduction says on the bottom of page 3. Where it says that the Hebrew basis of European religious thought has made it almost impossible for us to imagine a God who can be feared or laughed at, blamed and admired, and still sincerely worshipped. But as C.S. Lewis pointed out somewhere, I can't remember, you can't read the Hebrew Bible properly without being aware that much of it is written with a sense of humor. And the irony of Joseph's achievement is an instance of this comedy. In a lot of ways, as George Bernard Shaw pointed out, you ever heard of My Fair Lady? He wrote Pygmalion, which was the basis of that. The Bible is a singularly unreligious text. It is nothing like Dante's Divine Comedy, which is really about despair and hope and things like that. It is not like reading St. Ignatius Loyola. It is not like reading American Puritan writers. That is because, by the way, the Bible takes the very admirable position that we can hardly know anything at all about God except that there seems to be a right and wrong because his ways are mysterious despite what we are told by people and institutions that claim to know. Except for a few instances such as Job, which tells us to be patient in the face of suffering, and the Psalms, which insist on the value, if not the efficacy or the usefulness of praising God, there is hardly anything said about the nature of God or why his laws are this or that in the Bible. What we get instead is the history of the Hebrew people, especially under King David and Solomon, and the long laws of Moses, everything from what to eat to how to worship, and the lamentations of the prophets disgusted by the failure of the Hebrews to behave properly and to remember God. Although those two things seem to go together, that is, that there cannot be standards of behavior without some belief in a God, whatever that is, the Hebrew Bible has hardly anything to say about the consequences of mortality, which is perhaps the main reason for the New Testament coming into existence, since its main message is precisely the promise of a happy afterlife. For the confrontation with mortality, Homer is better than the story of Joseph, which is therefore like most Westerns, which according to Kowalty lack this recognition of man's longing for immortality that Achilles exhibits in the Iliad. So it's kind of a big claim I'm making there based on this, that the Homer is kind of more thoughtful than the Bible. Achilles' not clever Joseph is what Kowalty calls the archetype of the more complex Western hero. There are cowboy stories that are better. So let me read this quote from him. The tragic power of Achilles' predicament lies in the degree to which it forces us to confront the inescapable mystery of life, the terrible limitations of the human desire for immortality, and the inextricable relationship between glory and death. The predicament of Achilles embodies these paradoxes in the most overpowering and universal terms. In the Western story, however, the hero's situation is linked to a particular period of history with its limited way of life. It would be absurd to think that Achilles' problem, he's going to die young, would be resolved by a change in social conditions. But this is more or less the way we are made to see the Western hero, insofar as he is the embodiment of a particular moment in history. His failure or tragedy, the cowboy's failure or tragedy, can make us sad, but it does not forcibly bring us face to face with ourselves and our present life. In the destruction of the gunfighter, perhaps through marriage or disappearing into the sunset, we lament the hero's fate and we feel nostalgic about the passing of a time when men were men, but at the same time we see their sacrifice as a necessary contribution to progress. Their fate is not ours. The concerns of Achilles, like those of Hamlet, are not those of the cowboys. They are the joy... I messed something up here. Anyway, the joys of violence and the breaking of rules are transcended by the bitter but resigned acceptance that he will die, and in Achilles' case, die young, despite his wish for immortality. Unlike Achilles or the medieval chivalric knights who we're going to be getting to this semester, who were modeled on Achilles, cowboys may have a savage side, but they never seek out combat for its own sake, nor do they desire immortality. This limits what Kowalty calls the dramatic power of the Western. In place of transcendence, which is a fancy word for this longing for immortality, transcendence, in place of transcendence and unresolvable longings, the Western offers a formula that appeals to the essential world of the audience and offers resolutions for what greater art usually leaves ambiguous. And that ambiguity is going to be the big word today, the Agamemnon. It's hard to tell who's right and who's wrong. These resolutions are not located in the denouement or the unraveling of a plot. Denouement means the untying of the story, but in the setting of the story, which is one reason that the Westerns transferred so well to film. They used to be novels. Anyway, that's enough of that. Okay, so I'm just rattling on a bit. Trying to set this up because I think this stuff is pretty difficult to come to, and you want sort of... maybe by contrasting it to the Western, you can start to see that there's more to it. And I guess that taking the point, for Aeschylus, today we're going to talk about imagery and irony. All right. And for Tuesday, we're going to talk about this thing we might call action, or what you were talking about as decisions. Okay. What makes Oedipus so interesting is that he thinks through everything.
He weighs, this is your point, okay? He weighs it all. This play towers above everything because you have the thinking hero. And he gets everything wrong. And that's why it's a tragedy. And it just shows you, man, it's like, it's tough out there. Okay? If you had to do it all over again, you'd make the same stupid mistake. And everything would go to hell. And that one gets to us. That's the definition of tragedy, right? Tragedy in the Aeschylus sense is slightly earlier, not quite up there with Sophocles. Sophocles wrote the Oedipus Rex, and this Agamemnon is written by a guy named Aeschylus. Now, there's long histories of tragedy, and I don't want to get into it, because I think that the important things are these, the imagery versus action. We know that there were festivals in ancient Greece that you competed, that a guy like Aeschylus wrote maybe 90 tragedies, but only a few survived to us today. Right? These were kept alive in Greek manuscripts. They were translated into Arabic, whatever. We have a few of them, but there's enough evidence that we can reconstruct the things reasonably well. I have a nice big word I just found this week, which I thought I'd use. It summarizes this point I'm trying to make. I'm doing this book on C.S. Lewis. That's why I keep mentioning him, because I'm reading all this stuff. Right? In his diary, when he's 22 years old and he's taking his second undergraduate degree at Oxford, he's sitting down to read Greek history. And after he gets done with Herodotus, and he's moving on to Thucydides, and he gets to what he calls the Pentateuchia, right? Which is the period of time from 480 BC to 430 BC. 50 years. Pent means five, so this is the 50-year period. And this is so crucial because it's the time from when the Athenians defeated the Persians, which I keep talking about, okay, to the time that they, through the 50 years of the glorious age of ancient Greece. When we think ancient Greece, we're really thinking of a 50-year period. Okay, this is when these tragedies come from. It's when the Parthenon is built. Okay, Greek sculpture, all the beauties of art that came out of ancient Greece, which survived because they were made in stone, all right, so that's always a good idea. And they really are spectacular. At the end of this period, everything started to fall apart because the Athenians got involved in what's called, and I always spell this wrong myself, so I'm going to look. Got involved in the Peloponnesian War. The Peloponnese is the southern part of Greece. In other words, you've heard the war between Athens and Sparta. Okay, and this just dragged on forever. And it's the story of Thucydides, who's on your syllabus, tells the story of this. Herodotus, there are two ancient histories. There's one by Herodotus, which is the early world, and he talks about Egypt and everything else, and the myths and the origins of the Trojan War. And he's sitting there in Greece, and he's trying to figure out the world. Who built those pyramids? Where was Troy? You know, he's trying to figure it out. That's what Herodotus does. And then Thucydides later gives us the account of the horrors of the Peloponnesian War when Athens fought Sparta. And they essentially, it was decided not in Greece, but in Sicily, right, in a huge naval battle. And I taught this once in freshman composition back in the days when men were men. We did Thucydides in my class. It was an honors class. I think it was the Spartans actually won the naval battle, which was surprising, and they put the Athenians and 500 people in a giant pit and let them die in the hot sun. Tempers ran really tense back in Athens after that disaster, and all the generals were brought onto the carpet for a really serious grilling, and everything fell apart. Not good, right? That's the era of Plato and Aristotle. Okay? in the 390s. Things are falling apart all the time because of political problems. But in the era of the tragedies, we're in the glorious time when the Athenians could celebrate their victory over the Persians. Okay, with modern Iran, they'd come into Greece, they'd burn the city, and they, as I said, the Athenians pulled back, got in their ships, deserted their town, and when the Persian supply lines grew thin and they couldn't maintain the occupation, they drifted back, and they defeated them, and they retook Athens, rebuilt their walls, and had this 50-year period of glory. Okay. Well, that's the historical background. Let's take a look at this play quickly. The story comes out of Homer. Anyway, let's not get too confusing. It opens up. It's the story of the homecoming of Agamemnon and his murder by his wife, Clytemnestra. Right? That's what happens in the play. Agamemnon comes home. His wife lures him inside. And off stage, he gets his throat cut in a bathtub. And Clytemnestra comes out at the end, and she produces her boyfriend, Aegisthus, who helped her. Okay? Who's right and who's wrong is the big issue, but everybody's got an excuse. This looks like the story of a scheming, nasty, awful, horrible woman named Clytemnestra who takes a lover, and when her husband comes home from the rigors of the war, she shows her true unfaithful colors and murders the poor guy. But then again, she comes out at the end of the play and says, you know, that guy's a creep. We remember him with his slave girl, okay, in the camp with the argument over Agamemnon. And not only that, when he comes home on his little chariot, standing behind him, he's got his new squeeze, that's a word, Cassandra. Another one of the daughters of Troy, who's a prophetess. So he shows up at home with his girlfriend. And he expects his wife just to sort of, you know, accept it because he's big, powerful Agamemnon. Ah, you know, we men are like that. You know. Suddenly she doesn't look so bad. Okay. Yeah. I was just getting to that. Good point. But that's not all she's angry about. I was going to delay it forever. Okay. She got another beef with her husband. Okay. Before he could set sail to Troy, he'd gathered all the Greeks in the ships in the story, and the wind was unfavorable. It was blowing out of the east, and the ships couldn't sail east into the wind. And a magician, one of these seers, stood up and he said, you know what the problem is? The gods are unhappy with you going to get Helen. You've got to do something to make them happy. I suggest you sacrifice your only daughter, Iphigenia. And Agamemnon, according to different stories, either goes ahead and does it or agonizes over it, but he finally does it. He sacrifices his daughter to allay the gods so that the army can go and sail to Troy. Makes sense. Gotta pay attention to the gods, right? They want a daughter, you sacrifice her. Sort of like Isaac, okay? What? He doesn't have to pay a dowry now. Yeah. Yeah, right. Complete dismissal of the rights of women. It's obvious this guy's creepy. Okay. But his wife doesn't think so. She is not happy. Yeah. You tell me. If you know more about the myth than I do. His daughter is good enough for me. Did he have more? Okay. In do you know which story that comes from? Oh, when Agamemnon offered Achilles different His own daughters?
Yeah.
Huh. Okay. Okay. I don't remember that. Very good. So he had other daughters, but this is the one they asked for. Okay. And generally, it doesn't matter how many kids you have. Every one of them drives you back. So. Okay. You read that. If people have 12 kids, they still don't go into lifelong mourning if anything happens to one of them. You think, well, they got others. But it actually doesn't work that way. Okay. It doesn't work that way, believe it or not. So, well, the third thing that beef against Agamemnon is and we get this right at the end of the play when the Clytemnestra comes out with Aegisthus. And Aegisthus says, well, I've gotten my revenge too. And we're thinking, well, who are you, Jack? I thought you were just a lover. Okay, what's your problem? And this is hard to. I taught this many times, and I still get confused with it. But it turns out that there were two. Why don't you look at the end there? Help me get this right on the board. There was a guy named Thyestes, and he was the brother of Atreus. And they feuded somehow. And what does it say? Let's look at the other so we get it straight. Aegisthus turns out to be the son of Thyestes, okay, who's the brother of Atreus, who's the father of Agamemnon. Okay. And Atreus, Atreus drove Thyestes out of town. Thyestes came back as his guest. And then Atreus still hated him, so he served Thyestes a dinner made up of his ground-up children. Okay. So, this is an insult. Okay. And Thyestes then put a curse on the house of Atreus, which is lasting through Agamemnon, which seems to account for the fact that he has to sacrifice his daughter and then eventually gets murdered by his wife. Right? So they're actually cousins. So part of the revenge of Aegisthus, to revenge his father against his uncle, is, of course, the great Sicilian motif. I seduce his wife. That gets him. Okay? There's revenge, you know? Sounds like a Robert Redford movie somehow. Okay? Right? So that's what he's doing. He's getting his revenge at the end becomes the lover of Clytemnestra. And of course, she's looking for something, right? So when the play starts, there's a lot of stuff in the background that's not really obvious. When we get to the first page, it makes reading it so difficult, right? But it's really the point of the structure of the drama. Right? There's a watchman on the roof who's been assigned to look and see look for the beacon fires that will signal the end of the Trojan War. Okay, Troy's here. You got the Aegean Sea, and we're over here in Argos, I guess. Okay. And there's Troy. So when it falls, every 10 miles, there's a mountaintop beacon set up. Okay? This could actually have happened, this kind of thing. You set up these signal fires to get the message across, because it would be a lot faster than sending a ship. And the signal would be that the signal they're waiting for is the end of the Trojan War. Right? Were you not live when Charles married Diana? You were 6 years old? Do you remember when they died? Do you know who those people are? It's nothing wrong if you don't. It's fine with me. Okay. But during their wedding, I think it was 1981, they did these signal fires right across England. Okay. You know, they relayed. One fire was lit, and then you could see it out there on the hill, and passed it all the way up to from London all the way up to Scotland. It's, you know, it's quite spectacular. And this is what's being waited for, the signal of the end of the war. All right, now here's where the irony comes in. Everything's got two meanings in this play. Right? That's all you want to be concerned with, is kind of lining up these two meanings. Is it good or bad? And the answer is it's both. That's why it's so tragic. It depends where you stand and who you are. Okay? The signal fire ending the Trojan War sounds good, doesn't it? Put a guy up on the roof, right? But why do you think Clytemnestra really wants to know that the war is ending? Yeah, I mean, Mr. Beastly Husband is coming home, and she's got to be ready, okay? So the signal fire seemed like the imagery in the play makes it sound like they're the light of civilization. Ah, God, the war is over, now we'll light a new torch and lead the way to future generations. I, the class of Harrison High School, pass the torch of learning on to the class of 2008. Okay, right? Torch of learning, of life, of goodness, right? But it's made of fire, and fire burns. Right? And there's going to be some big trouble. But it doesn't stop with this play. Because when Clytemnestra murders her husband, that really annoys her son, who's named Orestes, who is not so upset with his missing sister, by the way. Okay? And Orestes, and this play is actually part of a trilogy, and in the next two plays, Orestes kills his mother in revenge. I think that's the second play. And in the third play, he's up for trial. Was he guilty of killing his mother? Right? And it's a really knotty problem, which is solved in a really stupid way, which I'll save for a minute. Okay? But it's solved in a trial court. Okay? So for Western civilization, this trilogy, which is called the Orestia, after Orestes, represents the triumph of a fixed system of law and justice, the establishment of a system of law and justice in the law courts of Athens, even though it's set in Argos, this is being written in Athens. Okay? The Athenians, they project all the bad stuff onto their neighbors, but it's a celebration of their own law courts. And this is the myth of Western justice, that you can get out of a curse on your house, these constant blood feuds, by setting up a system of justice. This is a very rare thing. Right? We have it in America, and it's funny how fragile it is. It's certainly what they're trying to set up in Iraq, but they haven't got it at all. And now the scandal is, you know, a judge in Colombia just admitted he was on the take, and so the whole justice system in Colombia, South America, is falling apart. You can see the myth, the desire to have an abstract judicial system that can weigh guilt without getting personalities involved, to break out of the curse, the constant retribution. Right? It's the point of the world court. And this idea we trace in Western civilization to these plays. Well, let's go back to the watchman. So this poor guy is sitting up on the roof all night. And we start with him. I mean, if this doesn't... If you just come to this play cold, you can't get anywhere. I'm on page 506. Dear gods, set me free from all the pain. The long watch I keep, one whole year awake. Well, why is he awake for a whole year? Well, he's been on the assignment. Same reason people in the Navy take amphetamines. Right? If you fall asleep, you get court-martialed. What a little sidelight. Not that you should take amphetamines, but that's the thing. He's staying awake because he's scared to fall asleep. Who's he scared of? Well, who put him up on the roof? Who's waiting for the news from Troy? Clytemnestra. Right. So that's your first signal. That woman is in control of this town. This guy is petrified up there on the roof. right? She's keeping him away. And also, I mean, it's clear he knows exactly what's happening. Right? Everybody knows that Clytemnestra is sleeping with Aegisthus. We don't know as we start the play, unless we know the story. Or it's not mentioned openly, but that's the mood here. Things are tough at home. Okay, you know, the head woman is, oh boy, this is going to be a mess when Agamemnon gets home, right? So he's scared, and he sees the beacons, and we get this incredible double imagery of the sort of light of civilization and the terror that's coming. And then we get the chorus to comment on the thing, and this is sort of page 512, and they make your point about Iphigenia, right? They recall the sacrifice of Iphigenia and make you start to think there's some tension in this town because Clytemnestra is very unhappy about the sacrifice of her daughter. So the chorus's role is to remind us of it. Okay. It also, a little sidelight, the priest who made Agamemnon sacrifice his daughter was named Calchas. Have we heard of that guy? He's the one who was working for Achilles, who got Agamemnon so angry. Now, Homer didn't mention it, but this Greek myth stuff is like too much. It's all connected. Nobody can quite figure out how it got so connected, but you can see even Homer starting out with this irony, this unspoken tension between Agamemnon and Calchas, who he can't like, because he was the one that predicted or told him he had to sacrifice his daughter. Well, then we see Clytemnestra for the first time. Let's jump to line 345. Let me just mark the line and you go back and read this. And she's there sacrificing to the gods, and she gives this long speech about the beacon of light, right? And its meaning. And she talks about the fall of Troy. And at this line 345, she calls for the safe return of the conquerors. And you're going, what? I don't get it. Wouldn't she just assume they run the ship aground? And Mr. Beastly husband doesn't come back? Well, no, then you don't get to kill him yourself. Right? You know, it's not as good at a distance, right? So this is not the Western. We don't do it at a distance. This is a real moral confrontation, and it's complicated. It's ambiguous. We're not sure who's right and wrong. There's right on both sides, and there's plenty of wrong to go around here. And I think that may be symbolized by the fact that she's got to do this herself, up close and bloody. Right? Let us jump. I could go through the whole thing, and but life's too short. Page 526. Let's just flip to that. Okay. Well, there's all sorts of double entendres with here. In this scene, you see at the two-thirds of the way down, Agamemnon enters. Agamemnon enters in his chariot, his plunder borne before him by his entourage. Behind him, half-hidden, stands Cassandra. The old men press forward. This is an incredible tableau, right, that he's standing on this thing. Right, just to straighten this out. Well, I'm home. Yeah. Oh, mighty Agamemnon, you are up there. Yes, how are you? Oh, who's that behind you? Is there somebody behind me? Yeah, what's she doing here, you know? Okay. Well, she doesn't say that, but that everybody can see it. So you have the visual stuff going against the word. It's very powerful, right? And what does Clytemnestra do? What? See, she doesn't want to say anything because she doesn't want to scare him off, right? And back inside the house, Aegisthus has, you know, got the knives being sharpened, right? So she rolls out a red carpet. Come on down, mighty hero. You're back from Troy. We have a red carpet for you. Well, we all want to walk the red carpet, don't we? I certainly do. Okay. But Agamemnon's got a little, oh, what? The red carpet. Yeah, sure. Wait a minute. Clytemnestra is kind of bitchy. I'm a little worried about that, you know? But I'm Agamemnon. I have a power. I'll do it. Well, what does the red carpet mean? It's ironic, it's got two meanings. It's the glorious welcome for the mighty conquering hero. But as Clytemnestra says, let's see if I can find the line. Line 900. Jump to line 900. This is where she lays out the carpet, page 530. Women, why delay? You have your orders. Pave his way with tapestries. Quickly, let the red stream flow. That's on the exam, right? So you want to know now. Okay. You know, you took the course, and you get the irony, and I'll spell it out. Okay, the red stream, she means literally the carpet. But it sure sounds like the blood that's going to flow when she gets inside. Right? And it works so perfectly because it's his pride that overcomes him to accept the invitation to walk down the carpet. And it's that pride is the reason she wants to kill him. Because, you know, he put himself first. Right? The actual murder takes place off stage, and it's narrated by Cassandra, who is of the daughters of Troy. The one he brought back is the one who's been given a curse by the gods for various reasons, that she will speak the truth and no one will believe her. So she starts narrating. She's sort of seized by the god in this, like ESP or supernatural inspiration, and starts describing the murder. And in fact, it's happening out there. That's enough for today. I wanted to get too confused, but you get the idea. It's pretty powerful stuff. Just scratch it, okay? So this is a play built on this kind of imagery and irony, and the one for Tuesday, if you get a chance to read it ahead of time, do, because it's so complicated. But the main thing, it starts with Oedipus. There's a plague in Thebes, and Oedipus comes out and says, what's going on? What should I do? And everybody says, well, you should send to the oracle and find out why. And he goes, well, I already have. He's thought of everything. He's so smart. He'll figure out what's causing the plague, who committed the murders of King Laius at the crossroads. Nothing will stop him. And of course.